Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on list.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s. And each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well-qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Well, I can't believe all the things that have happened here in the last couple of weeks. I think I'm most upset about the Diet Coke button being removed from the Oval Office. That is un-American, unacceptable, and honest to God, I really want to find out how I can get one because that's a great feature. And Dave, thank you so much for inspiring me. When I'm allowed back in the studio on a regular basis, when we can actually pull this off, and I was hoping it was going to be February, but the way things are going with COVID, I'm not sure. We are definitely installing that one in the KMOX studio. Newsweek magazine's opinion editor Josh Hammer is back with me this afternoon to talk about a bunch of different topics. Are you a Diet Coke guy, Josh, or not?
I'm actually not really a big soda, pop, whatever you want to call a guy myself, to be honest with you. I drink a lot of water or a lot of coffee and no shortage of whiskey, and those are kind of my vices.
Oh, there you go. Well, unfortunately, I'm a Diet Coke addict, and it's not good for you. I know that, but it is what it is. How are you doing in this new year? And I know I've read a couple of the columns that you've written. Maybe we should go back a couple of weeks because I know you had some strong feelings on what happened on January 6th, and we'll kind of get to what happened yesterday and the executive orders and stuff. But I was rather disgusted with the past couple of months, including with my friend Senator Hawley here in Missouri, and I don't know how this is all going to play out, even moving into the future.
Yeah, so thanks so much for having me on, Mark. I actually disagree a little bit when it comes to Senator Hawley. I prudentially disagree. I think that was the wrong manner in which to bring a claim like that. I'm currently the opinion editor of Newsweek, right? But I'm actually a constitutional lawyer by training. This is kind of my wheelhouse. In a situation such as this, where there are widespread irregularities, peculiarities, there's, mail-in balloting questions, rejection rates, the proper avenues the Constitution affords, the remedial measures, are on the one hand, of course, litigation. You can always pursue that track in the courts. And what you can also do is you can convene at the state level, because the states are ultimately responsible for certifying their electors, the Electoral College. According to statutory law, it's always December 14th each year. The states can convene commissions to investigate this sort of thing at the state legislature level. And if need be, they can actually then send competing slates of electors to the Electoral College, which is something that's happened actually any number of times. The election of 1876 is the best example of that. The issue for what happened this year is that no Republican-held state legislature got their act together in time, so to speak. That didn't happen. On December 14th, the Electoral College slate was 306 to 222 in the count, which ended up being the final count. So this January 6th process, which is traditionally viewed as being just purely ritualistic and symbolic, was not the proper means to address these concerns. They should have been aired earlier. On the merits, Senator Hawley, I think specifically, was objecting to what happened in Pennsylvania, which is pretty, at least from my perspective, was the clearest cut state that blatantly did not follow its own election law. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court had a flagrantly unconstitutional ruling there that the U.S. Supreme Court unfortunately failed to hear the case of. So I think I disagree with the way in which you raised it, but on the substance, I didn't really have an objection. All that said, though, President Trump's conduct was obviously appalling. It was obviously appalling on January 6th. It was an irresponsible decision to hold that rally at that time and place in the first instance. And his failure to immediately and quickly and unequivocally condemn what was going on at the Capitol. Eventually he did, of course, but his failure to immediately do so, I thought, was pretty dire.
I agree.
Let me
stop you there, though. On the thing with Hawley, you know, I understand what you're saying, and I always allowed for the irregularities to be investigated. The issue that I had with Senator Hawley and others is that they led people down this path to believe that something could be done after December 15th or whenever the electors were slated. And I thought that was what was most objectionable to me, especially because, and Josh, so I've known Senator Hawley for a long time. He was on my show maybe even 10 years ago, and I brought him in as the official. He had an intro and everything, and that's very special. We might be able to get you one. He was the official constitutional law expert of the Mark Reardon Show. He clerked for the, you know, for the Chief Justice, well, John Roberts at the time. And, you know, he was solid on this, and I like his philosophy, and we're on the same side with many of the issues. But I thought that I had to retract that because, you know, he was leading people down a path constitutionally that wasn't, there was no path constitutionally on January 6th.
Right. So there really wasn't. And I do not disagree with you on that. You know, John Eastman is a friend of mine. He's formerly clerk for Clarence Thomas. He's affiliated with the Claremont Institute. He was one of the president's lawyers throughout all this litigation. He had an interesting piece the other day, basically arguing that the vice president's role in, quote unquote, certifying electoral college returns is necessarily a little bit more than purely symbolic, which is what I was saying earlier. And to an extent, that's correct, right? I mean, in a situation where they actually submit competing slates of electors, it does seem like it is the vice president following a debate of the Congress to actually who is constitutionally bestowed with the decision to choose which elector is fully legitimate. But again, I think you and I are on the same page insofar as the states didn't do their job here. They didn't actually send competing slates of electors.
Well, and you know, let me go back a step before that, because and I've been trying to find out more information about this. You hear competing information. I've read a bunch of pieces. But with Act 77 in Pennsylvania in particular, couldn't that lawsuit have been filed well before even Election Day?
Totally. There was a huge failure here on the part of, you know, local Republican parties, local Republican lawyers, activists, Republicans. And, you know, I've been a registered Republican since the day I turned 18. So I can kind of just say we here. I think we were really kind of caught off guard, which is unfortunate because it was so readily foreseeable. I mean, as soon as kind of COVID hit, we knew that mail-in balloting would occur. You know, at Newsweek, I hold these kind of debates of the week. It's kind of like a point counterpoint op-ed kind of thing. I held a debate on mail-in balloting last June. I mean, a long time ago. So we really should have had this litigation well out in front of November. And to be clear, sometimes there was. Some of that did exist, but it clearly did not happen the extent to which it ought to have happened. And look, this notion, again, that the vice president can just kind of thumbs up, thumbs down, single-handedly overturn the Electoral College where the states themselves have not even submitted competing slates of electors, that's a lie. We should feel comfortable calling that a lie. To the extent that anyone was complicit in that, they should be criticized, they should be held accountable, and so forth. The president, I think, certainly holds the most responsibility there out of anyone.
I mean, we agree on that, right? Yeah, Josh Hammer, opinion editor at Newsweek. So let's kind of push it forward here, and where, from a couple of different perspectives, where does the populism go, especially if Donald Trump doesn't have a voice out there on social media? There's still people, and now you have millions of people who feel like they've been labeled as racists and, you know, bigots and all this stuff. So where does that channel itself moving forward, especially because it's complicated with Trump not really having a voice right now?
It's a really great question. I mean, this is kind of one of the million-dollar questions that we're kind of sorting out in real time as we speak. Look, from my perspective, Mark, my perspective on this is that there's no going back to the way things used to be. I think Trump, it took someone of his formidable stature, someone with all the marketing talent, the charisma, no matter what you might say about his, you know, various insecurities and faults, his fame, and the fact that I think he did not mature through the institutions of conservatism, right? He was a true outsider. It took someone like that to kind of break through the Republican Party and I think make a lot of conservatives rethink a lot of kind of the old orthodoxies that have become stale and cobwebbed over time that don't necessarily as readily apply to our circumstances in the year 2021 as they applied in the Reagan-Bush platform of 1984 when they kind of reached their zenith. And I think he was deeply effective in doing so. So now we're kind of in the phase where we're trying to turn quote-unquote Trumpism, which really is kind of just a more nationalist, populist kind of form of conservatism. From my perspective, from my reading of history of conservatism, I think it's, for the most part, a truer version than kind of the more dogmatic, you know, free trade is the greatest thing ever version of conservatism that we were sold for decades. But now we need to kind of take that and use our institutions, our the media, use all the levers at our disposal to actually craft a policy agenda, ideally with, from my perspective, ideally without Trump being the sole figurehead. Because after January 6th, I just don't think he's well equipped to do that.
Yeah. On your thoughts on what's happened here. Let's talk this, the new administration. So one of the last things that they did, and I know you're passionate about this, is the State Department declared that the Chinese government is committing genocide and crimes against humanity with the Muslim ethnic minorities. And then you have all the executive orders that come in yesterday. So let's talk about China first. Is this something that will be also continued by this administration?
Gosh, you know, I hope so. I would encourage your listeners to, if I could just do a bit of a self-plug, to go to our Newsweek opinion page, because literally just this morning we had Gordon Chang, who's probably, for what my money's worth, my single favorite China-related commentator in the current discourse right now. He actually has an op-ed on this precise issue, kind of urging the Biden administration to continue Secretary of State Pompeo's very bold, courageous, and I would say accurate designation that the Chinese Communist Party is committing genocide in Xinjiang. This is a huge deal, Mark. We don't know everything, obviously. There's a lot we don't know because China's infamously tight-lipped about what they do internally. They don't allow in international investigators or things of that nature. But what we know is deeply harrowing stuff. And, you know, look, I don't generally like to invoke this when it's not directly relevant. But look, you know, I mean, I speaking personally here, I mean, like I am Jewish. I've been to Yad Vashem, the State of Israel's Holocaust Museum numerous times. It is kind of our responsibility to call out what clearly does appear to be a genocide, even if it's not in quite as sprawling a scale as Nazi-era Germany, when we see one. And it would just be truly, truly abhorrent, I guess the word I would use, for the Biden administration to rescind Pompeo's courageous designation in order to pursue, you know, liberalized trade or commerce or just friendly diplomatic relations, whatever he might choose to prioritize. Something of this nature, Mark, simply has to take priority. It just must.
But isn't it also fair to criticize the Trump administration for not doing this sooner?
Absolutely. Totally correct. I wrote a column last week urging Trump to kind of officially diplomatically recognize Taiwan as an independent state on the way out the door. Another thing that I don't understand why he didn't do sooner. I think it was right when he was inaugurated in January 2017, he became the first U.S. president since the U.S. de facto adopted the so-called One China policy in 1979. He was the first U.S. president to accept a congratulatory phone call from a Taiwanese official. So it was all laid out for him quite clearly to do that. And I am actually very disappointed that he did not do that. Similarly, I think it's totally fair game to criticize him for not doing that in Xinjiang early enough. I mean, we've known about this for at least a year and a half now, probably closer to two and a half years. So that's totally fair game, I think.
So on the executive order, time earlier this hour on Keystone, that seems like a purely political move. We're going to see this, though. And I've said, and I think I've seen your tone on your tweets and some of your pieces, it seems like everything is going to be framed around race and gender moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like we're kind of, you know, if I can just kind of like wax philosophical for a second here, America is traditionally a religious society. Okay, if I can say something that is kind of just a bit of a truism, we're all familiar with the founding quotes, George Washington's farewell address, where he says that a free society cannot endure without morality, and religion has always been understood as the best safeguard of morality. Just a few years later, John Adams says that the Constitution was made for a religious and moral people. It is wholly inadequate for everyone else. But and, you know, while a tight-knit group of, evangelical Protestants, devout Catholics, Orthodox Jews, et cetera, has that those groups have definitely endured. And if anything, they've actually proliferated. Orthodox Judaism is actually the fastest growing sect of Judaism in America, which is wonderful. But at the same time, the overall percentage of Americans who are religious has just gone down, right? And I say all that as just a bit of a wind up to the notion that when you lose a sense of belief in God, when you lose a sense of religion and purpose in kind of a more transcendental sense, you need something that to kind of come in and take the place of that. And it never can truly meaningfully do so, but you're going to need some sort of ersatz religion, I guess you would say, to kind of come in and give you pseudo meaning. And I think what's going on with race in America right now, this kind of racial reckoning, is exactly that. I think this is a lot of way for a lot of, largely speaking, probably less devoutly religious Americans to kind of feel like they're kind of getting their spiritual religious fix in, is through this great racial reawakening in the aftermath of George Floyd and all the riots this summer. And we kind of saw some allusions to that in Joe Biden's inaugural address. And I think that's going to be a recurrent theme for the next 4 years. I wish it weren't so, but I do see it being so.
Yeah, that's an interesting analogy, and I'd love to think about that one a little bit more, but I think you might be onto something. Josh Hammer, who's the opinion editor at Newsweek, great stuff. I've been reading it and seeing the tweets. I like a thinking person on the show, so thanks for coming on here this afternoon, Josh. Really appreciate it.
You bet it. Thanks so much, Mark.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.